birthday party?
Miracle. There you go. Welcome to the Abracadam Podcast, and I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician Danny Whitson. I hope my Abracadamans are getting stuff done, son, like always. It has been a wild, weird, and crazy week for me. I've gotten a lot of stuff done. I was interviewed for a magazine this week, which I totally didn't see that coming. So, kind of cool, definitely kind of cool, but doing good, getting ready to head off to the beach, which is a much, very, very much deserved vacation, I feel like, because, we didn't even go on vacation last year due to all the pandemic stuff. So, but definitely doing good. I tell you who I'm doing better than. I don't know, maybe this guy's doing good too. I hope he's doing good, but I read an article, not a story, about a guy, I'm not even sure what country this was, but he got hammered. He got hammered drunk, and he noticed there was a search party going on in his town for a missing person. So he thought he would do a good deed, like we all do when we get drunk, and joined the search party and tried to find this missing person. And after a couple hours, he realized that the person they were looking for was him. So, I mean, I've been pretty drunk before. I've been totally wasted before, but I don't think I've ever been that drunk to where I went looking for myself. That was, maybe the guy's doing great though. Maybe he's doing good. I don't know. But I tell you what, let's get right into this episode. Let's give a big shout out for the sponsor for today's Abracadam episode. Okay. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Rosie Tattoos. Custom tattoos designed to suit your style in a friendly and clean environment. I've been getting my tattoos done by Rosie for a while now, and I couldn't recommend anyone else because she does excellent work. As a matter of fact, I got an appointment to see Rosie here in just a few weeks, and I cannot wait to get my ink therapy done, baby. Rosie gets free consultations by Facebook Messenger, Instagram, or by email. Shoot her an email at rosietattoos@yahoo.com. Give Rosie a call today at 865-281-3451, or go see Rosie at 5710 Kingston Pike, Knoxville, Tennessee. Get your ink therapy done. You know you want a tattoo. Go see Rosie Tattoos. All right, Abracadamans. Now, to say that I'm super excited about today's guest is severely an understatement. I've been a big fan of this guy as long as I've been into magic. He has contributed so much to the art of magic. He has so many books out. I have them all except for one, which I need to get, by the way. But he's had a big influence on me. He's had a big influence on so many magicians out there. And he's just not a magician either, though. He's also a writer. He's a comedy writer. This guy understands so many things about entertainment. Every now and then you meet somebody that has so much talent, it's kind of unfair. Well, that's today's guest. So if you will, please sit back and relax and enjoy my fun conversation with magician David Regal. All right, I'm excited for today's guest. We got David Regal on the Abracadam Podcast. How you doing, David?
I'm good, Danny. You do seem excited. Holy crap. Just take a pill, Danny.
Well, you know what? I really am excited. This is like when you really meet Santa Claus and find out that he's real. You know what I mean? This is what it's like for you.
So Santa Claus is real. Santa Claus is real. Okay.
So many gifts you have brought to up-and-coming magicians into this world, David Regal. Really, there is. But I tell you what, for the people who may not be familiar about who David Regal is, David, do you care to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Oh, geez. Well, I won't be as effusive as you. I, in I grew up in the Boston area. I moved to New York and joined a comedy group. And we just performed constantly for many years. Then I moved to LA, became a TV writer slash producer. And for a long time, my secret passion was magic. I mean, magicians knew that because I'd put tricks sometimes into magazines and stuff like that. But when you're in LA, it's a strange place. And I had an agent that said, don't let anyone know you do magic, because he was afraid I'd only be offered writing jobs that involve magic. And whether he was right or wrong, he was passionate about that. But eventually, as I guess had to happen, though I'm happy it happened, those two lives converged. And I started writing, producing The Carbonaro Effect, which is both things I enjoy. It's comedy and it's magic. And I thought, okay, this job is very difficult, but when will I ever have another job like this that combines those things? So that's sort of my life in a nutshell. I started out as an actor, became a writer. My obsession slash love magic eventually seeped into my other life. They combined.
You know,
and look, an angel got its wings.
You know, there, like I said, there's so much we could definitely talk about with you, David. But and that's one thing, like, I even noticed about The Carbonaro Effect, the way that it's got the magic, but it's also got that hilarious moment, like the candid camera that you used to get when you watched, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, it is, and like candid camera, hidden camera show, yeah.
And it is, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And you starting off as in comedy first, I started off in magic, and I came into the comedy club a little later, and I put magic away to learn stand-up, but then I came back to magic, and I didn't realize how difficult it was to make magic and comedy work. And it's because, you know, good comedy is telling the truth and good magic is bullshit. So,
well, interestingly, to talk about the Carbonaro effect, I was brought on the pilot, so it wasn't my idea. It really grew out of a premise that started on The Tonight Show. They had a magic clerk, and they cast Michael in that role. And Michael and other people thought, wow, this could be more than just a segment. This could be its own show, its own kind of world. It could be expanded upon and magnified. So I was brought in on the pilot, along with other people. But very early on, I turned to the producers who kept saying, our magic show, this magic show, this is going to be a magic show. I said, this is not a magic show. And they sort of made the Scooby-Doo noise. You know, but I'm passionate about that. And, you know, as head writer of the show, I, you know, me saying it's not a magic show, for me, I was really imploring people to believe that. To me, it was a show about a very strange day in the life of the mark. And the mark is jargon for the person on whom, you know, the deception is being pulled. Why is it not a magic show? Well, it has no magician. I mean, Michael Carbonaro is an excellent magician, but in the scope of the show, he's really in the segments portraying someone else, a shopkeeper, a co-worker, an employer. So in the there was a wink to the viewer. The viewer does know this is magic being done and that Michael can perform magic. But in the body of the piece, he's never performing a magician. And in the body of the piece, there is no magic because the mark absolutely needed to believe it was a real world experience. Which, you know, interestingly enough, cuts off like 95% of the magic repertoire. Because if you go into the Thick Tannen's magic catalog and look at every trick that exists, about 95% of them fall under the umbrella of, I'm a magician and I'm going to be showing you a trick. And the Carbonaro effect is, I'm not a magician and I'm not going to be showing you a trick. So we had to pretty much come up with our own material now and then. Would find something that would work for us that was actually, you know, over the counter. But if we did 800 bits, maybe that was 12 bits. So almost all the bits were things we had to sort of you know, work together on to come up with premises and methods and all that stuff. So for me, it was never a magic show. Never. And when we'd have magicians come in to pitch, very often we'd get great pitches for magic tricks. And I'd say it's really important that we know what the mark is believing is happening. And it took some magicians a while to sort of, you know, come around to that. And I used to make it a requirement. Eventually I made it a requirement. You have to also pitch what the mark is believing is happening. So we did a lot of them, and not for one day did I approach it as a magic show, even though we had to employ magic to meet our ends.
You know, I mean, of course, as a magician, one of the fun things is watching the show. Sometimes you recognize the tricks that are taking place. Some of them are routines that you've read about in books, but you've never actually really done. And now I'm getting to see them done, which is, that's the fun side of it. But also, every time I watch that show, I bust out in laughter every damn time, you know?
Yeah. And that's a combination of things. Number one is Michael. Michael's super funny. Yeah. Super witty. And, you know, it's also, I mean, it's no secret, it's a group effort. So there's a lot of people working to make the show good. But yeah, number one is Michael. And not only does he make it funny, he makes the show possible because people believe him. And that is not a small thing in a show like this. If he was not seemingly without guile as he is, you'd have to just do a show about stupid people being pranked.
Yeah.
The Carbonaro effect is not that. And if we felt it descended into that, we'd kind of reprimand ourselves and, you know, try and, you know, make it better. So it was really a show about people believing something they shouldn't be believing. And we're watching their belief system being challenged, A, and then being defeated, B. And that's really what the show is. I mean, there is a magic trick, which is intrinsically funny. And the fact that they these marks are believing something they shouldn't believe, and the viewers understand that is the game. We're going to make them believe something they shouldn't believe. That, to me, is the show. And I doubt there are many viewers going, I wonder how they did that magic effect. I think the integrating part of the show is you know, watching the belief system crumble. And yeah, I think some magicians go, how the hell did that work? And honestly, some of the stuff that I was part of, I don't remember how we did it. I watched it on TV again. How did we do that? Because it was, you know, so much material, so much process. I mean, more than one time, Michael and I would be talking about some idea, and Mike would say to me, or I'd say to Michael, we did that. It aired because there's so much.
Yeah. And it seems like it's still going, though. You guys are still cranking out new stuff.
Well, no, with the pandemic, it stopped the show because of all that. So I don't know if it'll come back or not. We were talking about doing more right up to the pandemic. But, you know, when things stop, they tend to stop. When things are going, they tend to keep going. But, you know, who knows?
Well, you know, the thing that's so interesting about you, David, is, I mean, you are good at so many things.
I'm a jack of no trades. A jack of no trades.
But, no, this is rare. It really is rare. For one, in magic, okay, you are an amazing creator of routines and effects. And then you're also a very good performer as well, which those two things are kind of rare. And then on top of it, you know, your comedy background, your writing, all these things. Now, were you made in a lab, or did you just have a very supportive, you know, fan crew growing up?
This is not a complicated answer. I've always, I mean, I do different things, which is either good or bad. The good part of it is I got to try different things, explore different things, I mean, different situations, some good, some horrible, you know. And I enjoy that. But of course, by bouncing around, you know, you just have this crazy sort of, you know, lifespan. Now you're doing this, now you're doing that. And it's not like, when I was 20 years old, I decided to brunk, and that's all I did. So I've just always done different things. But in general, I'm in the make people less miserable business. And if I make them more miserable, I have failed. And if I make them less miserable, I've succeeded. And I feel that's true in just my life as well, you know, in interactions with other people. I feel I'm a success when people are less miserable or lifted or feel empowered or better. And at my worst, you know, and as a person, you know, I'm dealing with other people in a way that minimizes them, or they feel trivialized or marginalized. So, you know, that's sort of the way I've always been. I grew up, not surprisingly, I grew up in Newton, Mass. And by the way, Newton, Mass, not only did my parents get divorced, every friend I know had parents that got divorced. I just thought that's what happened, you know, everyone got divorced. So that's my shorthand way of saying it wasn't not a big deal, it's very common. But I grew up in a very unhappy house, very unhappy, you know, where dinners were like, oh, you dreaded them because my father had a terrible temper and very demeaning guy, and he would make people feel bad. And, you know, it's like every night one of my sisters would end up crying, or maybe one would run up to a room and slam the door. And my poor mom would say something and be mocked by my father. I mean, it's like a play. And so I was the youngest, I was the baby. But very early on, I would like excuse myself for some reason, go halfway up the stairs. It was a two-story house, halfway up the stairs, and come down and do a bit, just some funny, stupid bit, trying to break, you know, that awful tension of silence, you know, around the table. You know, I mean, literally people staring at their plates and pushing food around. And so I did that all my life. So imagine a little kid all his life, is all he's doing is coming halfway down the stairs and doing a bit. And basically professionally, I've been able to make a living and I'll retire having done nothing but bits. I've just done bits. Sometimes in a room with writers, sometimes they're, you know, behind the scenes at America's Got Talent. I go different places and just do bits. And sometimes they love me for doing it. And sometimes they go, who's this guy doing bits? And that's just sort of my professional story.
Well, you know, David, I thank you. David, you are a blessing. Really, you are to so many people.
Oh, you're nice to say that.
And, you know, this is how I want to break it down. Now, any magicians listening to this will totally understand this. But I'm going to go back the late 90s, early 2000s for me. This is my
Duran was at the top of the charts. David Regal is making a name for himself in an improvisation group on the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
Well, I remember discovering Paul Harris at Art of Astonishment. Okay. And I remember this was magic like I've never seen in my entire life. This was so insane. And I remember finishing those books. And I was like, you know, I was like a crackhead. I was walking around. I needed more of this type of magic. And I remember going into the magic shop and I was like, you got any more of that Paul Harris? Anything else? Anything like it? And the guy was like, right over here, you know, and he showed me a David Regal effect.
Well, you were so emphatic. If you were really that way, I would have shown you anything to get you the hell out of my store. Because you look like you're a crackhead or something.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's how good this is. So David Regal's magic was it's got that AOA feel to it, you know, and in some ways better. Yes, I said it better.
Well, no, it's a very nice compliment. I mean, Paul Harris is fantastic. And a lot of people around that time were fantastic. I mean, right now, plus, you know, my lifetime, I turned 65 in a couple of months. So my lifetime in magic has seen magic get better and better and better. So when you say Paul Harris, yeah, and Jay Sankey, when Jay Sankey was coming out with his stuff, it was very dynamic and very different. And, you know, and other people, Daryl, the late Daryl, his material, man, what a wise and well, magically educated to the nth degree gentleman he was, and talented. And when he'd do magic, I mean, this is stuff. You'd watch Daryl do magic and anyone knew, oh, he's this much better than everyone around him. And, you know, one of my claims to fame, I mean, now with cardistry, it's a different situation. But back in the day, I remember I learned that hotshot cut of Daryl's from the book. It was just pre-video. And no one learned it from the book because, you know, learning nothing from the book was ridiculous. And so I had, you know, 6 months of pride in magic being able to do that hotshot cut, which I learned from the Steve Minch book. And I actually was writing for a TV series around that time. And they needed, I had written an episode about a church charity event at which the lead characters were trying to win all the money that was going to go to charity. And so it was a mixed blessing. They won, but then they're basically stealing from children. And I had written in a nun doing a fancy cut. I figured we'd get some female magician. We couldn't find a female magician for the shoot day, whatever the reason was. So they put me in a nun's habit and just shot me sort of from the side. And I did the hot shot cut to show that, you know, I was like a card whiz in an abbreviated amount of time. Because if you can just do it in a couple of seconds and get the joke across, so much the better. So that's what I did.
That's awesome.
And, I used to have that footage somewhere, but I think it was probably a 3/4-inch tape. So that's long gone.
Now, well, you know, first of all, the hotshot, man, card magic has came so far from those days. I was lucky enough to learn that cut from Daryl's videos, which, you know, Daryl was a fantastic contributor to the art of magic. He, you know, so
yeah, many, just really great. Oh, and yeah, that's what I say. Around that time was so much good magic. Michael Ammar was putting out those fabulous encore booklets, which later became his hardcover book. And of course, David Roth. Think of what David Roth was doing around then. So in the world of close-up magic, a lot was changing, but magic was growing up in a lot of ways, maturing in a lot of ways. And Penn and Teller, you know, at the time was very controversial. They came out as the bad boys of magic, exposing magic. And it seemed to magicians at the time completely inexcusable. Now, I'm not trying to say what was right and what was wrong back then, because I think you could even point to specific things and say that I can understand why they did it, that I don't. Well, I'll give you an example. When they did the clear cups and balls, which exposed all the moves, that I felt was a great, great piece that no magician could really complain about, because it really, who was it that said, manipulation is the only form of magic that does not suffer from exposure. I forget who said that, but I read it, you know, decades ago somewhere. I wish I knew who said that. And anyhow, the clear cups and balls is an example of that, because it seems so intricate. You're more impressed with the skills and of a magician and the craft of magic, in and of itself. But other things they did, exposing the thumb tip, you go, well, that seems crass. Well, why would you do that? So I can understand people fighting about it, but the macro is they were a very different kind of magician. And I'll give you another example. Two Davids, David Copperfield and David Blaine. No one's confusing the two of them, because these people are extraordinary interpreters of magic. And David Blaine, people forget how controversial he was.
Yeah.
He's doing tricks I have in my drawer. Why do people think this stuff's good? Why do they think it's good? They couldn't see it. It felt like he wasn't performing because he was just going so against the type of performance that was the stereotypical magician. But what he really was doing was making his audience believe he could do this shit. And that, you know, you can't say it's groundbreaking. That's probably how magic started. You know, people believing the performer could do that stuff. But when David Blaine was doing that minimalist approach, the floor opened up under those people, and it took magicians a very long time to grasp what was happening there. Because first it was just outrage. How can he do those tricks?
He literally changed magic. He changed magic with, you know, David Blaine did.
Yeah. But a lot of great interpreters, and Darren Brown is my favorite magician. What an interpreter of magic he is. And, you know, we've seen this kind of growth in our lifetime. So, yeah, everyone complains, isn't there more crap now? Of course there's more crap. with YouTube, isn't it more crap? Yeah, but I look at it, I think, more optimistically than some people, because I think the ratio has stayed the same. If it's always been 90% crap, 10% good stuff coming out, I think the ratio stayed the same. So that volume of crap is now, wow, it fills the barn. But the 10% also grew, or whatever that percentage is. Maybe you'd say, oh, it's only 1%. Well, okay. That 1% grew along with the 99%.
You know, one thing I had kind of worried about when I was thinking about the future magic, we were talking about the past. And now, of course, you put out fantastic stuff for magicians to learn from. But nowadays, with the internet, and this topic has come up plenty of times in conversations with magicians, to where the internet has helped magic in some ways, but in other ways, it has hurt. Now, do you think this is a possibility, that this is what the future could look like? The good stuff may one day not be available, and the only way to access the good stuff is that it goes back to the old days of sitting down face-to-face with a mentor and learning, you know, at a table, instead of something that you can pop up on YouTube and learn in 5 minutes?
Well, first of all, not all magic is something you can learn in 5 minutes. I mean, and you know, this whole idea of self-working angers me. It just angers me, because performing well is not self-working. So you could take a trick that's technically challenging and perform it terribly. I mean, technically correctly, but terribly. You could take a self-working trick and perform it terribly. And of course, the converse is true. There could be a trick that's technically challenging, that's absolutely blisteringly effective, and a self-working effect. A good example of the latter is, you know, Danny D'Artiz is putting out this, I'm one a month, any card, any number project now. And no, I'm not a spokesman for, you know, Danny or Penguin Magic, but it's a really good example, because I review things. They ask me to review things now and then. And I got to review one of those Danny videos. And he, of course, is a modern day master of card magic. People say, where are the masters? Well, you know, they're not hard to find. Juan Tamariz is, you know, putting out so much material. And Danny is too. Danny, when he does his, I guess they essentially become, I've only seen two of them, 1 hour lectures or 45 minute lectures. And he doesn't pause for breath. And what he's delivering, and the two I've watched are not technically demanding effects. I mean, you could, maybe there's an optional moment that is a move, but he said you don't have to do it if you don't want to. But in general, not technically demanding. However, what is he teaching if it's not technical? He's teaching, I think he had a phrase for it, but it's basically the naturalness of the performance being a core weapon and a core method, and how to reach that state, and not just in a mental way, though that's part of it. He'll break it down to everything, even down to the tempo of what you're doing, as well as the physical actions that you're doing. And it's fascinating and it's great. So yeah, I'm a little angered by the idea of the ad saying things are self-working. And I don't think anything, look, anyone can get lucky and be good at doing something effectively. But even a great singer doesn't sing everything fantastically well. And not every song is appropriate for every singer. So magic is, you know, I see it's exactly the same as music, exactly the same. There's material, there's arena, there's ability, and judgment ends up being the number one requirement to be any good. It's not the number three requirement, not the number four requirement. It's the number one requirement. And it's easy to prove that, because by and large, if there's a move you need to learn for some effect, you can learn the move. By and large, you can. I mean, let's not point, well, this move's so hard, I could work my whole life and never do it. Yeah, those moves are rare. Those moves exist. But in the breadth of magic, generally, you have the ability to learn what needs to be executed technically. in terms of effects, if you're rich, you have no barriers. I want to be an illusionist, and I'm going to buy, I have all the money to buy all these illusions. Okay. So you have all the ability you need if you work at it. Well, if I spend 6 months at this, I'll have the ability. And let's pretend you have the money. I have all the money I need to get this and this and this. What don't you have? What can't be, drilled? And what can't be purchased? Judgment. That has to be cultivated. And it's super important, because when we see an artist, performing material that's just 100% correct and nothing's left on the table, I mean, everything's delivered, that's the result of judgment and picking, the right effect and understanding where the beats are and how to magnify what can be magnified and minimize the limitations. All effects have limitations because we're not really magic. So what are we, minimizing in the presentation? Danny's work is all about that, magnification and minimization. And I really recommend it. He's just great. So I appreciate your compliment, but we are living through a time of fantastic magic.
Well, okay. So I also want to back up a little bit, because you did mention Penn & Teller's clear cups and balls routine, which I remember that being a big stink when they were doing it. And when I watched it, I thought, well, that's brilliant, because, a layman could watch that routine and still have no clue how it's, actually really done. They pulled off something fantastic. Now, speaking of the cups and balls, which is, a classic of magic and probably considered the effect in magic, whenever I was studying the cups and balls, I went and, like most magicians, learned the Vernon routine, learned some of these routines, and then I stumbled across your routine. And I was so impressed, because the way you brought it all the way back around, which was just brilliant. And now this is kind of what I want to ask, though. I don't want to talk about so much about what happens in a routine. For anybody who hasn't seen it, go to YouTube. You can check it out. It's absolutely amazing.
Oh, you can see the fuzzy young me performing that.
It's great. It really is great. It's a piece of art, because it's a story you're telling, which is beautiful. But do you think your background in writing and comedy and the stuff that you did prior, before you, I guess, became performing magic, is that what aided you into creating your original stuff, your own stuff?
Well, yeah, I'm pigheaded on this subject. I mean, you probably think I'm pigheaded on all subjects, but all magic is written, and it's nutty to think it isn't. I mean, it can be poorly written because you didn't pay any attention to it. But if you're performing it for a person, they're following something, or hopefully they are. And for some reason, well, I think we know the reason, because of secrets, presentation and premise and interpretation are given short shrift in magic, because it's a secret-centric craft. And we, a lot of us have a hunger for secrets, and we all love a good secret. Oh, we're all delighted when someone shows us something that fools us. Oh, and here's how it works. So we love the secrets, but the secret is not the end. And the comparison, or the analogy I like to make, is the singer buying sheet music. No singer buys a sheet music and says, I'm done now. No, you're not done. You have the sheet music that allows you to continue. And, find someone to accompany you, find an arrangement, start singing it and realizing where your emphasis is going to be and your phrasing. It's what you need to continue the process. Well, a secret's exactly that in magic. It's something we need. And you want a good secret for that arena, for those conditions. You want the best possible secret, meaning one that's elegant and ergonomic or whatever. So you don't want a bad secret. So I understand we all want a really good secret for our needs, the needs of that performance. But the secret shouldn't be the thing that says you're done. It's just something you put here, and you can improve it and play with it, but it's just part of everything. And that's what stops most magicians that are mediocre. that's what stops them, because they think it's just the secret. And to give them a little slack, there are some tricks that are so good that just performing them is impressive. I'll give you an example, Matrix, Al Schneider's Matrix, of which there's now many versions. If you perform it adequately, whether you're doing Michael Ammar's Shadow Coins or the original write-up of Matrix, if you perform it adequately, it's beautiful magic. You don't need to say anything. There's a lot of magic, you don't have to say anything. And it's very impressive. And so because of that there's some tricks like that, a lot of magicians, even professional magicians, have this urge to find all those. Am I allowed to swear on this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You say whatever you want, David.
All the unfuck-upable tricks. In other words, anyone can do these tricks. They're going to be deliver the goods. Well, that's really a dangerous road to go down, because you can go down that road and you can gather those tricks. Oh, look, here's my act of 10 tricks. And they're all, you know, clad in iron. Well, okay, now you're exactly as good as someone else who has those 10 tricks. But yeah, they found those 10 tricks too. And yeah, that was the story of Zigzag, one of the greatest illusions ever created. It's so bulletproof. Every magician did it. And it lost everything. It just lost everything. Because it became the hack trick, for one thing. And which is ironic, because it's such an effective and brilliant illusion, one of the greatest illusions of all time. But yeah, the magicians were no bigger than the other magicians that had the zigzag. So that's true about all magic.
I was going to say, you know, you brought up the zigzag. And one thing that, you know, magicians will say a lot of times, they will look for an effect that no one's doing. And I don't do that per se. If I take something into my show, I put my own personality into it. I put my own presentation into it to where no one could do that effect. And it's, you know, based off a lot of stuff, you know, from watching you, David, the way you present your magic, you put David Regal into your routines.
For better or worse.
it's good stuff. Always, guys listening, it's always good stuff. And so that, I think, someone could do the zigzag illusion if they did it, you know, their way. But yeah, I totally agree. There's people.
Well, interpreting. I mean, my most recent book is called Interpreting Magic, because to me, that's what makes a good magician. I mean, you have to choose the right material and create, you know, solid presentations, but interpreting is the word I go to, because we, well, again, to talk about singers, when we go to see a singer, we don't say, honey, put on your nicest dress. We're going to see the singer that's the same as every other singer's. No one's excited about going to see the singer that's the same as every other singer. If we're going to an athletic event, that's not me. But I imagine we're excited about seeing a team that's different from other teams, because they're from our hometown or there's a player we idolize. No one wants to go to a performance of dance from a dance, you know, company that's the same as every other dance company. So in all the performing arts, we are seeking interpretation, not as a bonus. That's a prerequisite. As an audience member, for us to be excited or engaged, we're engaged because we want to see the interpretation. In theater, I can't wait to see this actor perform this role. I paid $100 for the ticket because I'm going to see this actor in this role from the repertoire. And it excites us, it thrills us, and we're driven by the desire for interpretation. And in magic, the fact that I'd say it's the last thing on some people's lists, but it doesn't even appear on some people's lists. They're just executing, you know, the steps of the trick. They're doing something that should not be possible in the physical world. Okay. But there's no interpretation, really. I mean, even to a point of, what are we seeing a demonstration of? And in just a pragmatic way, every audience is desperate for those rails, that premise. I'm showing you this because, and it can be anything. Here's something I've been working on my life to perform. I've never done it. This is my first time. Here we go. Oh, my grandfather left me this. I don't know how it works. We're going to find out. This is a relic I bought in a store. They say it has a power. You hold it. Let's see what happens. I mean, that premise seems like nothing. So a magician's like, oh, it's a line at the top because they're so secret-centric. It's not a line at the top. For the audience, it's what they're experiencing. It's really fundamental. And again, not to beat it to the ground, every other performing art, everyone knows it's about interpretation. Everybody, the performers and the audience. And for some reason in magic, there's confusion. So I wrote a book called Interpreting Magic to try and, you know, untangle that knot for some people. And, you know, everyone's interesting. I like people. I look, there's horrible people. I know that. But in general, I like people. And people are fascinating. And for us not to interpret is leaving out quite a bit from a presentation.
And I think it's also, I mean, it's a way to relate to your audience. You know, if they, especially through magic, when they see the magician who is doing something with these weird looking things they've never seen before, but, oh, well, I've had a situation like that too, what he's talking about. Yeah.
But look at anybody. I mean, Eugene Berger, the late Eugene, what a great performer. In general, he wasn't doing technically difficult things in general. But my God, everyone that saw Eugene Berger perform, I'm talking about real people, not magic convention people. What a memorable, dynamic, funny, interesting performer. I'd say the same for Derren Brown. I mean, I went to Liverpool to see one of his shows, and I think in the 2.5 hours, he did 6 tricks. He was interesting for 2.5 hours.
Yes.
Engaging for 2.5 hours. And he was everything. He delivered everything. Heartfelt moments, funny moments, self-deprecating moments, amazing moments. So much happened in that 2.5 hours.
You know, I watched his special, the one I watched on Netflix. I think it was, I think Derren, he kind of attacked almost the organized religion aspect of it. Almost had you believe. It's almost like there was an up and down where he plays with the audience to where, you know, is this real? Is this not real? Is this kind of really happening? And he pulled it off so well. And I was like, this is somebody creating art, not magic.
He's a phenomenal performer.
I love that. Definitely a big Derren Brown fan. Let me do this because, like I said, there's a lot of stuff to talk to you with, David. Can you tell us about your experience with Rugrats and Everyone Loves Raymond? I would love to hear.
Well, I've written for a bunch of shows. Those are the two that are the best known. But I've had a very much the working man's experience as a TV writer in L.A. I've written for shows that I've liked, not liked, that you knew existed, that you didn't know existed. I've written for shows on networks you didn't know existed. I wrote for shows on the WB. The WB, even my own family would say, oh, we don't have the WB. Actually, Mom, you do. You just don't know you have it. It's a network. You know the Warner Brothers who made all those movies like Casablanca? Well, they have a network now. You know. So I was always going from job to job. Some jobs would go 3 years. Some jobs would go 6 months. And I came up through animation because I had no credits when I moved out here. And I just, you know, started with that first, I got to submit some material to someone at Klasky Chupo, the people that made Rugrats, for a different show. They had a show called Ah, Real Monsters. And I got hired to like write one script. And when you're hired as an outside writer, you're not on salary. You get some amount of money. And in this case, animation is not in the writers' union. I don't know why. I'd say snobbery, actually, because when you come to thing like Rugrats, which made as much money in the ancillary markets as like Friends. I mean,
wow.
Yeah, Rugrats. I ran it for a year or more than a year, but I came up. I didn't start writing it. I remember there was a full page ad in Variety that said, thank you, Rugrats, for the $1 billion, with a B, dollars worth of ancillary marketing this year. It was like a full-page ad in Variety. And I thought, wow, and we're non-union, which means, you know, the writers didn't get, you know, royalties or residuals. So you wanted very much to move into sitcoms, even though Rugrats was the number one show and I loved the show. You know, I had a family. It's like, oh man, you're so jealous of people writing on sitcoms because they're getting residuals, which is, you know, your retirement and all that stuff. So yeah, so I clawed my way into sitcoms after coming up through animation. And I loved Rugrats. Very, very talented group of actors and a strange family. You know, there's, you know, dark stories behind Rugrats too, and, you know, the personalities and what went on. And but the end result, you know, very uplifting show, very positive show. And everything I have done, especially stuff with a lighthearted end result, seems to have drama behind the scenes, not of my own making. But I was always amazed, I think, because in entertainment, there's just some people that will do anything, anything to get ahead. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything. So think whatever you want to think. I'm saying it's anything. So yeah, you meet great people and have some, you know, wonderful friends, but you also meet people you can't believe. You just can't believe. Like something out of a bad novel. You know, you're really doing this? What?
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, that's been my experience anyway. I think there've been people that have never run into, you know, the ugly side, if you want to call it that. But yeah, I've run into it. I've been in rooms where, you know, a male writer broke into tears in the room because it was just such a poisonous atmosphere. I was on a show and a female writer called me, and this was a new show in its first year, a sitcom. I didn't know her, but I guess she felt safe calling me, and she broke into tears because the way the showrunner was behaving. And so it's serious, you know, pain and dysfunction, unless, you know, you happen to be on a well-run show and everything's great. And I've been on both. So I'm grateful for, you know, the good ones and the bad ones. I think I blame myself for years. What did I do wrong? Because I felt very guilty because I had a wife and kids. Oh my God, why did this job go so wrong? And I'm sure in many cases, there's plenty of things I could have done right if I was more savvy or more seasoned. But I can't tell you how many times I was on two shows where people quit. No one quits when you're a TV writer. No one quits because the jobs are hard to get. They pay well. And no one quits. I was on two different jobs, shows, ongoing shows where people quit because it was so poisonous. They could not continue.
Wow.
Yeah, it's almost unheard of. And I've on two occasions, people contacted me out of the blue to apologize. I was unprepared to apologize because in retrospect, they couldn't live with what they'd done. I mean, and so I fold in my blaming myself for being green or new to it with people calling me to apologize. So, yeah. So anyone who thinks it's a walk through the park, not necessarily. I survived, as I say, I turned 65 in a couple of months. So I survived it just fine. But yeah, the highs are fantastic and the lows you cannot believe. It's like, how can this be a comedy show? Or how can we be writing a cartoon? But yeah,
that's so okay. Well, first of all, let me say this: 65 years old, David Regal looks amazing.
Not yet.
Well, not yet, but 64. David looks amazing. He looked fantastic.
Thank you.
Why
was I had a fish for 45 minutes before you gave me that crumb?
let me ask you this because I find this interesting. It's not every day that you actually get to talk to a writer who has, you know, worked on the shows you have. Now, one thing that I hear from a lot of people, especially people my age, is people say, Hollywood's all out of ideas now. They keep doing all these reboots. And I, for one, I can't stand it when they reboot, you know, some of my favorite films.
Yeah, it drives me crazy too.
So do you think the writers are out of ideas? Is there any truth to that?
I hate to be jaded, but it's exactly what you think. I hate coming from something very negative and telling you how tough the business can be. if you're unlucky, you know, with a showrunner going through a divorce or whatever. But I hate to go from negative to negative. But yeah, I mean, there's very few decisions are made based on the quality of an idea. You know, the way things worked when I was, you know, coming up through the ranks is if you were coming off a hit show, you were gonna move on to a development deal and this and that. And that system didn't work. The only system that can really work is if an executive has good taste and reads something or hears an idea and goes, I like this idea. And that still happens. But very often, it's were you lucky enough to end up on the staff of a hit show? And then your career is going to go in one direction. And it's not like all the best writers end up writing on the hit shows. And all the worst writers end up writing on shows that aren't that good. It's a mix. It's just a mix. And I've been in rooms where you're surprised that, oh, that person, yeah, he or she actually can't write. Oh, that's interesting that they're here. I wonder how that happened. But it happens all the time. And every writer knows someone, you know, with that $10 million development deal that, you know, we're better than. Every writer knows that person. Every single one. And yeah, it's just nuts. It's a little capricious. And are we out of ideas? I don't think there were ideas to run out of. I think the only way to get a good result is to have people saying yes or no that have good taste, good judgment. And it seemed to me everything was made out of fear, the ability to justify a decision rather than the quality of the material. It got to such a crazy place where very often, those years I'd read the stack of pilots, I'd go, well, this is the worst one. More than one time, that one was picked up to pilot and continued on to be picked up to series and failed. Something I can understand that happened with one that seemed like in the middle was a 5 out of 10. Well, someone liked it. But when you pick the worst one, the one that any writer, not just me, any writer would say, this is the worst one. And that's picked up for some crazy reason. Because, you know, someone in research said a demographic with a 20-year-old black man and an 18-year-old black woman whose neighbor is white is going to be a great, you know, some crazy thing based on research. But this is how nutty it is. I mean, I sold a couple of shows into development, and I don't want to tell you to who, because it's not about bashing them, because everyone was the same. And I ended up friendly with one of the executives. And during this process of pitching, I knew I was close to say, oh, I really like that. We have something a little, it's not the same, but it's enough similar. I don't think we could do both. So I knew I was close, and the executive liked me because he knew I was in, you know, in the right area. And it got this crazy. The executive called me at home, unsolicited, said, David, he's being so nice. Here's what I want you to do. We just had one of our retreats. Come in next Wednesday. Pitch me an idea kind of based on this classic, you know, story scenario. And it was a work of literature. And I was familiar with it. And I said, sure, no problem. And I spent spent the weekend and the Monday and Tuesday breaking out the characters, you know, my own angle, stories, and this and that. The day before that meeting, he calls me in, David, forget it. We're not interested in that idea. And it was in the space of 3 days, they went from having something up here on the list of priorities to something they could not do. And that's the way it was for me very often. It's like, which way is the wind blowing? Over here, over there. And there were years, I don't know if you remember this, there were years where networks gave up on sitcoms. They were producing such bad sitcoms that no one wanted to watch because these were horrible. Horrible shows. They actually said, no, America doesn't want to laugh this year. And they, you know, broadcast reality. America doesn't want to laugh. It's not, that's where you go. Not that we're so bad at determining what's any good or that no one has any good ideas. And no, it's not about running out of ideas. I think there's always creative people. And not all, every idea is good, but the job of the whoever's making the yes/no decisions in the production company or at the network or broadcaster, that job is one of judgment. What seems like a good idea? Yes, can the writer? Do we feel this writer can deliver on it? Do we need to match them up with a more seasoned writer? These are decisions that have to be made, obviously, because mechanically you have to deliver a show. Is it castable? Can we put together people that can turn up the scripts, you know, every Friday or whatever? But, you know, that mechanical problem, it doesn't require geniuses. What requires someone that's rare are these jobs of decision making. What feels like a fun show? And, you know, all this prognostication about what the marketplace requires right now is almost always wrong. Almost always wrong. And yet, the process continues. We're going to, because they're so wise, they know what America needs right now. It's like, no, you don't know what America needs, which is why so much of what you develop goes into the trash can. So I think... No one's out of ideas. There's so much creativity. And, you know, we all know talented people. It's out there. It's just a matter of, you know, the hierarchy, you know, believing in things that they choose to believe in and succeeding or failing based on those beliefs. And that way you end up with people with success based on their discernment and not about, you know, which way the marketplace seems to be going, because that doesn't seem to be a successful way of, you know, making programming or content. They can always point to successes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Of course there'll be successes when you do that. But by and large, doesn't seem to be successful.
You know, and I kind of worry a little bit for my kids, you know, because when I can look back at old films and be like, that was a masterpiece. And they live on forever, some movies and television shows. And I worry about my children. Well, they're not going to have that. They're not going to have.
TV's getting very, very good. The best stuff is on TV now. Movies are getting worse.
Yeah, yeah.
TV's getting better and better and better. And, you know, part of that is all the, you know, the new paradigm and streaming and the way we watch. But, you know, I have these like shows like Mayor of Easttown, and, you know, you watch this and it's extraordinarily rewarding. And as I like to say, it's a full plate. You know, you're getting a full meal. And there's a lot of shows like that, and different people like different ones. And some are comedies, you know, you have Game of Thrones, come on. You know, and they cause sensations, and, you know, people can argue about this episode or that, but sensational, thought-provoking, exciting television, and in all genres, not just one, mm-hmm. and much less on network, and much less in theaters. It's not non-existent, but it's interesting how good has migrated.
I agree with that. That's, you know, and when you do find something good, it's good. You know, it is good. You know, just like you mentioned, you know, Game of Thrones. You know, there are some good things out there, but I just when I look at what Hollywood was cranking out on the movie side, I was like, you know, no offense to this, and this is an argument. There's people that argue with me to the death about this. But the Marvel movies have done things that comic book movies have never done in the history of comic book movies. Absolutely. What they've done is amazing. But comic book movies don't tend to age well. So people don't look back so much at comic book movies and make quotes like they do from The Godfather. So it's just, I just wonder about the kind of movie, you know, what are my kids going to look back and say, oh, this was a classic?
Always be good. They'll just be a different percentage of good.
Yeah. Well, let's do this, David, because, yeah, we don't want to roll down here in the dark, you know, black hole of negativity, you know. But I don't know. This might be negative. This might be hilarious, but I want to hear it. I don't care, because everybody who comes on the Abracadam podcast has to tell a good hell gig story. David Regal, you got one?
Well, one that comes to mind, I have to tread lightly, because a lot of my gigs, you know, for the past 5 years or more, I was working on the Carbonaro effect, and I can't expose how he did things, but I think there's an area where I'm safe. I mean, let's just say in magic, it's not really magic. So, you know, you use different methods and whatnot to get things accomplished. Occasionally, a method would require a human being to be contained in an extraordinarily small space. Well, I am the smallest person associated with the Carbonaro effect. I'm just small. I'm 5'6". If I haven't been eating too much, I'm very skinny. And so if an illusion required a human being to be in extraordinarily small space, very often it would be me. And normally it wasn't a big problem. I mean, if they just freshly painted that small space, I may start to hallucinate. That happened, literally hallucinating, because the paint had just dried, but the fumes were still. Yeah, that is strange to hallucinate while the success or failure of a piece of television hangs in the balance. But and talk yourself back to reality. No, that isn't happening. But very often on the Carbonaro effect, they'd want us to incorporate a live animal. It's very dynamic, really good video, and very amazing. Something about incorporating a live animal, which you know can't be trained to perform sleight of hand. A live animal is a live animal. Incorporating a live animal was just good for us. So we always had a lot of pressure on us to use a live animal. You'd be amazed how quickly you run out of usable live animals. Excuse me, I'll have some coffee. I hate relating this story. Now, you're looking at, of course, the moderately physical fit version of myself. But when I was a kid, I was not physically fit. I was, you know, always eating Wheat Thins in the basement by the box full. I was chubby. I had to buy my clothes, you know, with my mom in the husky section. My older sisters would make fun of me. So imagine me with the glasses and chubby and squeezing on my pants. And oh, it was bad. I was also completely non-athletic, or unathletic, I should say. Because imagine me, smaller than everyone, kind of chubby. Everything was working against me being anything positive as a human being. And I was, on top of all this, I was squeamish. I was afraid of some foods. I wouldn't eat them. I was afraid of them. I'm afraid of cheese. You know, I was afraid of fish, afraid of foods. I don't know why. And insects. You know, there'd be kids playing with insects when you're in kindergarten. Oh, look, I found on the tree. I was so squeamish. I still feel guilty. I starved a chameleon to death because a kid at school showed his chameleon off one day. He brought it to school. Mom, I want a chameleon. They cost like a dollar at the pet store and a dollar for the plastic thing. I didn't know you fed a chameleon live worms. And I was so afraid to touch a live worm. That poor chameleon starved to death in my basement. And I was too ashamed to tell a grown-up, I was in elementary school, that I couldn't touch the worm. I still feel awful about that. And if God turns out to be a chameleon, it's just not looking good for me. Yeah. No, I feel terrible about that. So how does all this preamble lead into this Carbonaro effect story of me in a small space? Well, you know, we're running out of animals. And we've done things, a lot of different things. You know, hedgehogs. Obviously, kittens and puppies. I mean, those are number one. Mice. Finally, we got to tarantula. Ooh. Tarantula. This is the guy with, you know, 60 years of guilt because he couldn't feed a live worm to a chameleon. Tarantula. So I don't think it goes too far as to say the person in the incredibly small space is instrumental in the handling of the animal.
Oh, man.
David, here's a tarantula. And I'm looking at this thing, and it's of course, a fucking monster. It's just a monster. It's the most terrifying thing. And they say, and David, it's valuable and very fragile. You know, we didn't purchase this tarantula. No, it's on loan. You know, it's like this tarantula. And here's the tarantula handler. It's like, be very careful about tarantulas. Oh, Jesus. Okay. So I'm getting the care of a tarantula. They're very fragile, very valuable. And of course, the TV bit, which costs a certain amount of money to produce, hinges on my ability to get over anything. And I was in the process of getting over. We've done things with other things like scorpions, and I'd have to get over that. And other, you know, slightly icky bugs and whatnot, you know, cockroaches. That was in the pilot. I had to get over that.
Ugh.
So, but now tarantula. It's in this little, you know, like Tupperware tarantula holder. And I'm in. I'm not vertical. I'm crunched into this tiny space with my little plastic thing of tarantula. And you may think that doing a hidden camera show is easy because people are always coming by. No, sometimes you have to wait an hour for a mark or longer. Because if you were unlucky and it wasn't a place that got a lot of foot traffic, you'd have to wait, would come up with some way to sneak someone in there. They thought they were there doing an errand for their boss or something and would catch them on hidden camera. So sometimes you wait an hour. So in other words, you don't want to blow a take because it might be an hour before you have another chance to get this bit. So there I am in the space with the tarantula, waiting. And of course, Michael does a preamble because what you see on TV is not the entirety of a piece. What made him convincing is sometimes he'd banter with them for a little bit, talk about the day or what they sell in the store. And all that stuff's not good TV, but it was crucial to making this person a believer. So I'm waiting. And now we're getting close. I can tell in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to have to do something with this tarantula. I take off the lid. I remember touching the tarantula for an instant before it scampered away.
Ugh.
I'm in a very small space. I have an empty plastic thing. And somewhere in the nooks and crannies of this tiny space, and I'm like on my side in the fetal position, somewhere is a live, fragile, expensive tarantula that's vitally needed in a space of 1 second coming up in 5 minutes. Ugh. So, you know, the cameras are rolling. I have to locate the loose tarantula without harming it and get it where it needs to be when I hear the word now, you know, essentially. And yes, it came off. I found the tarantula. I didn't hurt it. It got where it needed to be. And we returned the tarantula to its rightful loving owner at the end of the day.
Wow. Okay. First of all, that's like the sum of all fears for some people, because some people don't like being in small places and most people don't like spiders. That is, I don't have a problem with any of those things, but that made my skin crawl thinking to be in a tight spot like that. And then a tarantula, I don't know where it's crawling.
That just hit. Did something hit my shoulder?
What? And you got to be careful too. It's a loner, so. Oh man. Okay.
You don't want to say I broke your tarantula.
Well, let's do this. Let's do a thought provoking question real quick here, David. And I ask every magician on this show, every magician that comes on this show, I ask them this question. And magicians are special to this question. Only magicians get asked. Okay, David, if you were to wake up on a desert island and you realized you had 1,000 spears pointing at your throat from the indigenous people. Yeah, the indigenous people.
This is getting kind of a racist place, Danny.
Well,
it could be white indigenous people.
They are. They're white indigenous people. Okay. Very, very, very
violent, apparently, or scared. Let's get some. Okay, maybe they're scared. They happen to have spears. That's all they have. Because the toothpicks, and they're just eating shrimp with them.
Exactly. There
but
we go.
Now here Rudy. I am. Okay, I'll let you ask your question. Your typical, racist question.
Typical, yeah, the typical snobby white people that are, you know, live on desert islands. They're pointing their spears at your throat. And you have one magic trick you can show them to prove to them that you are a god. What magic trick do you do?
Oh, you know, there's that one I like very much that David Blaine did on one of his specials where he went to a third world country. And I remember being slightly put off because it was such an effective trick. And they really believed that magic happened. As a magician, I kind of loved it. I kind of loved it because, again, I don't rewatch these things a lot, but I believe the effect was in an arid climate, he found a leaf, rolled it into a tube, and poured water out. Wasn't that the effect? And it was absolutely, for them, a miracle. So, you know, it's interesting. That's a question of arena and venue. Because, and it's that's why magic is so great. Because it's always a question of arena and venue. I mean, you can have an act, and if I'm not a professional performer, I'm a guy who loves the process, and part of the process is here's the arena, here's the situation. Like I helped on America's Got Talent last week. That's its own arena. I would never say what I wrote for America's Got Talent would be absolutely right at this corporate event or this professional booking. Very different, but that's why magic's so great. Because who are you performing for? Where are you performing it? What time of day are you performing it? What happened before you performed it? Where are they going to after you perform it? These to me are really interesting questions, and trying to come up with something that's effective under those conditions, which was the Carbonara effect. We were all working together to try and come up with things when that particular location, because remember, we went to different locations all the time, and that particular location would be particularly effective. I wouldn't say everything was married to its location, but a lot was. A lot was. And those are often some of our best bits that could only live there. Same reason some of the best jokes are jokes that could only happen that one time. Those are the ones we have to say because we go, oh, this has never come around again. I'm going to say this joke. So, yeah, I would do that. I would do because water is life. And the life from the leaf where water is desperately needed, then you are a god. But that wouldn't be that'd be a so-so trick.
Well, hey, that would, you know.
In the, that would convince me.
And now, yeah. I was kind of hoping maybe you would do like sudden death with a crab or something like that.
I'm assuming these indigenous people don't know what playing cards are. Considering some citizens of the U.S. don't know what cards are. Not everyone's a poker player. You know, I did that Magic Castle last week, and I only did one card trick. It was mostly silly, crazy props. But I actually said, look, not everyone knows. I needed people that knew what the cards were. But I'd say, it doesn't matter. But do you know what the different cards are in a deck? And some people, and I go, it doesn't matter. You know, you can ask them over there and they'll tell you. Because, you know, there's no requirement that everyone in the world needs to know the cards. It's not like it was. You know, it used to be everyone in an American household had decks of cards and they were playing cards with their friends and relatives all the time. Yeah.
That's so true. Well, you brought up the Magic Castle. Now, you were just recently at the castle. How are things now in this post, I guess we could, can we say post-COVID? I don't know, but
it's different. I mean, I agreed to the booking that 2 weeks those masks came off. Do you remember those 2 weeks? Ralph's is our supermarket in LA. Shopping at Ralph's without a mask for 2 weeks was liberating. It was great. But then masks came back. And I didn't want to, you know, let the castle down. So I was going to take the gig. But I realized in my repertoire, everything I do involves, especially the parlor, involves getting people up. And very often they're getting the laugh and it involves their expressions and what they're going through. And the rule of the castle now is the performers, the vaccinated performers, don't have to be in masks, but the audience is. So I try to pick effects that could survive seeing my helpers in masks. And at the same time, I tried to acknowledge, I did a very silly, fun 20 minutes. But I did sort of acknowledge things. My first effect was I have a big glass of beer and it disappears behind a placemat and it reappears. And I mentioned the situation at the beginning. I thanked everyone for coming. I'm there with my beer and my crumpled up mat in my hand. I appreciate you getting in the car, coming. I know wearing the masks is a hassle, but you heard the new requirement in LA. If you're actively drinking alcohol, you don't have to be wearing a mask. I see a road to a solution. And that got a laugh, so it wasn't too heavy-handed. Then I talk about, we just have to hide the beer wherever we're going. And you know, now the beer can be hidden or appear. And it went into the routine. And going into the second routine, I also kind of acknowledged where we were. I said, my number one priority today is to make you all feel safe. Safe from evil dolls. And I bring out like a picture of an evil doll. what were you thinking? So I tried not to pretend we weren't where we were. And in terms of business, the Magic Castle, you know, is just coming back. So the first days of the week were slower than the end of the week, which became busier. But I think the people wanted to have a good time. It's going to the Magic Castle is kind of a process, even pre-COVID. You have to get dressed up. If you don't always get dressed up, that's a process. You get a drive, driving into Hollywood, depending where you live, can be a process. Valeting the car at the Magic Castle. Some nights, that's a process. You're waiting on a hill for 15 minutes. So now add to that, you know, the mask requirement, which takes away some of the sense of conviviality. So these people did all that. So my feeling was, you know what, just do a fun show. Yeah, I had tricks, but make it as fun as possible and break through whatever doldrums might exist for them and for me. Because, you know, my lifestyle changed too. Thank God my wife and I still like each other, you know, because basically it's us and dogs. I have two kids too, but they don't live in the house. So, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I'm glad I did it. It's a lot of work working the Magic Castle. You know, you do a lot of shows, but it's also a rarefied environment. I don't believe people who say, oh, it's easy to do magic at the Magic Castle. Mm-hmm. I think you have to work to do a good job anywhere. And I've done good shows in various places and bad shows in various places. And knowing the difference, I'd say, is important, and be willing to attend to repair damage or repair the bad parts of what you do is very important.
Well, I tell you what, David, first of all, this has been an amazing episode here on the African Dale. Before we get out of here, do you anything you'd like to plug or where can the listeners find more about David Regal or
anything? There's not a lot. I'm not plugging a lot. I mean, for magic listeners, I know most of your audience are not magicians. I do come out with products, and trust me, I know it might sound like, oh, you come out with products to be commercial. No, I come out with things that I want to exist. Sometimes the things I want to exist, sometimes occasionally someone shows me something, I go, I'll help you bring that to market because I think it's a fun trick or a great trick or a beautiful moment. I think in the next couple of years, I have some things coming out here and there. And if you go to my website, which is davidregal.com, you can join my mailing list and I'll send you, you know, twice a year, three times a year, here's something that's coming out. But I don't do it. No one would come up with magic. No one would say to their wife, honey, I'm going to the magic trick business. So don't worry about anything. No, do it. And for books, you know, quadruple that. Honey, I'm writing a magic book. You do it because you love it. You do it because you love it. So there's no law that someone has to love the same stuff I love. But it's important, I think, for people to realize it doesn't come from a place of anything but, you know, affection for the possibilities of something. And you know, like last year, I came out with knives in magic. There's some plots that sound crazy to lay people. One of those plots is color changing knives. Like, why is that a plot in Magic? Knives that change color? What? There's so many. Bill and Lemon to magicians. Oh yeah, Bill and Lemon. To a layperson, like, what? There's a what? A Bill? Lemon? What's one got to do? What? And it's like saying hello to a magician. To a magician, it's just something you hear every day. So yeah, I came up with color changing knives, and some people really appreciated that particular set because they just liked it. For them, it met criteria, and that makes me feel good because these people, you know, a few people after I'm dead will do these things. And I don't say that to be morbid. As a TV writer, your work disappears. I've written for a couple of popular shows, but I think even in the popular shows, in 20 years, if he's going to be watching episodes, not many people. But you come up with a magic effect and or a piece of equipment or a prop or a method, you're in a lottery. A lottery where maybe in 50 years, somebody, some kid or some magician is going to go, hey, I like this thing. And in that moment that you came up with all those years ago, that laugh, that resulting moment of astonishment, that's going to live on. And one of my favorite things to do in magic now is this trick that employs a picture of Billy McComb. To those who are unfamiliar, yes, imagine a grandfather. He was an older gentleman, but still performing to the end. Funny, kind of a comedy magician. Great magic, but a funny man. A wise man, wrote a lot of books. I had an effect where I realized I needed a moment at the end I didn't have. I said, Billy, would you mind posing for a picture that I'll tell people is my grandfather, but I want you giving me the finger. Just like this. Why? I go, well, it's going to be like, believe it or not, it's like this 9-minute card trick where I'm oblivious to the fact that my grandfather hated when I'd bug him with card tricks. I was just oblivious to it. And in the course of this long routine, I say, he's no longer alive, but he gave me this portrait of himself. And it's in a frame, so you can't see him giving me the finger. And at the end, I take it out of the frame as if he's loved me all along. I still don't see him giving me the finger.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's a very, very funny moment. And he's really giving me the finger. And that session we did became all, you know, he's working to the end. All his later period headshots were from that session, which was a real photo session, you know, with real film. And, you know, one role was him giving me the finger. And of course, now everyone thinks it was Photoshop. And I said, no, it was not Photoshop. He's really giving me the finger. Magicians who recognize it. Oh, you Photoshopped a hand? Nope. He gave me the finger. Why am I telling you this? Because he's been gone a while now. Billy passed away. But when I do that routine, I pull up thing, I hear 70 people in the parlor. This huge laugh, this big fat laugh. And who's getting that laugh? Billy's getting that laugh. Billy's not with us anymore. But through that routine, man, I love hearing Billy get another laugh. And yeah, for me, that's a great moment of magic.
Wow, that is awesome. That is awesome. David Regal, thank you so much for coming on the Abracadabra podcast.
This is my pleasure.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with David Regal. I know I absolutely did. David is a true treasure to the art of magic. He has contributed so many awesome effects, written so many amazing books. So absolutely enjoyed this. And also, it was definitely cool to get to hear him talk about what it was like being a writer on television shows that we have all watched. So not only David has contributed magic to magicians, but he's contributed humor to everyone with his writing. So I found this very interesting. I hope you guys did too. If you guys have not done so, be sure to like, follow, subscribe to the Abracadam podcast. Seriously, anywhere you listen to podcasts, we're literally on every platform out there. Just search Abracadam, we'll pop up. Give us a follow, subscribe, because we got some super cool guests coming out. So you definitely don't want to miss that. Now I'm getting ready to head to the beach. I'm going on vacay. So like always, Abracadamits, thank you for listening.
Awesome.
Hey, will you please stop drinking vodka at my kid's birthday party?
Then you got a freaking miracle. There you go.